Hey y'all, it's Tommy. Today on the podcast, we're talking about life celebrations. And as it just so happens, we have a big one here at WFAE. We are celebrating our 40th anniversary as Charlotte's NPR news source. The traditional gift for 40 years is a ruby, but there's a better way to celebrate. Make a donation in any amount, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a $15,000 gift card to Lowe's Home Improvement. See the raffle rules and donate now at WFAE.org. And by the way, if you got a stash of rubies, we'll take them. Now, let's start the episode.
I do understand feeling reserved and not wanting to talk to a stranger about the person you're about to marry. That's a little weird. By the same token, like when you would get these people to talk and they would really kind of open up about the people that they were about to spend the rest of their lives with, that helped clarify for me that it wasn't just this like super hot, bonfire. It was like the slow warmth that you need every morning when you wake up.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South influences who they are and what they do. Today, we're talking about the thing called love with my guest, Kate Doty. She's a Southerner, a University of North Carolina grad who now lives in Raleigh. But she spent a key period of her career working on the wedding desk of the New York Times, writing about the couplings of the rich and powerful, and sometimes other folks too. And along the way, she fell in love herself. She writes about all of it in her new book, Mergers and Acquisitions. She talks about how she could sometimes tell when a marriage was going to turn out wrong, and how the rest of us can tell when we find the one who's right. You might hear some occasional thumping in the background of today's episode. Some folks came to work on Kate's house at a time she wasn't expecting. But sometimes you just gotta roll with it, in love and in podcasting. Here's our conversation. So, Kate Doty, in your book, you talk about interviewing a famous feminist about her upcoming wedding. And as part of that conversation, she gives you a piece of advice, which is when you get married, to not write about your own marriage. And damned if you didn't do exactly that. So what made you decide to do that?
In my defense, I only wrote about the lead up to my marriage. I didn't write too much about my actual marriage. It's funny, like people have been asking me, what are you going to write next? And I have sworn to myself and my husband that I will not talk about, will never write in depth about our actual marriage, like the ins and outs of the past 11 years. And certainly we have a pretty garden variety. This is hetero marriage in a lot of ways, and we've faced loss and stresses and all the things that that come with that. But what made me decide to do it, this book is a memoir. And when I started thinking about how to write this book or how to write the stories of the wedding announcements, when I was writing the Times wedding announcements, it was at the same time that I had met and was dating, successfully or not, the man who would eventually become my husband. And the stories just felt as intertwined as they could possibly be. You know, there are vines that wrap around each other. And because it was when I was writing about the wedding announcements, I was learning about commitment and I was learning about how people decide to make the leap into, what they think is the final frontier of relationships. Although for many of us, we may make that leap more than once, or twice, or three times. Michael, my husband, and I talked about it a lot. And I said, well, do you want to vet the stories before I put them in the book? And he looked at me like I was a crazy person. And he said, no, this is your book. You tell the stories of our marriage, of our relationship, and then our eventual marriage as you see them and as you know them. And so he actually didn't read the book until we got the hard copies back in April. He read the pieces about, he read some of the things, but he didn't read all of it.
That was interesting because I was wondering if he or any of the other people in your family you write about in the book, there's an ex-boyfriend in there too, and that sort of thing. If any of those people had any trepidation or whether any of those are just now seeing what you wrote.
Michael did not have any trepidation, or if he had any trepidation, he did not voice it to me. Maybe that will come out in marriage therapy years from now. Who knows? Who knows? You know, the future is bright. My ex-boyfriend, who is a major figure at the beginning of the book, of course, I told him about the book. We're still in contact. We still live in the same basic geography, to be frank. And I told him about the book after I had submitted the second pass pages, which, as you know, is like the second big round of editing, you know, when you're publishing a book, big, deep copy edits and all that. And I just felt like I needed that space and that time to basically find the courage to tell him that this was going to be a thing. And we have a somewhat staccato continuing email dialogue about this, because he has every reasonable expectation of privacy. He is, for the most part, a private figure, although I will say his public persona is rising for different reasons. And one of the things that we had to change, that I was made to change by the wonderful legal team at Penguin Random House, was his ethnicity. And that, for many obvious reasons, really bothered him. And he said, well, what does that, and the way he framed it in emails, it was very like, oh, interesting. But, you know, obviously it really bothered him. And of course it would. And he said, well, he asked me a very good question, which was, how often does that happen to white people? And I have no idea. And I would love to know the answer myself. I mean, one of the points of the book, this is getting off topic from the question you asked, is to talk about the whiteness of the wedding announcements and the whiteness of this world. And he is one of the very few characters of color. And I didn't make him white, but I did, the legal team saw flexibility in changing his ethnicity that I didn't realize, I didn't think existed, but to them it did. And I think some of it is a game of numbers, and some of it is rooted in something a lot more nefarious, I would say. But at any rate, I asked him if he was going to read it, and he said, well, I'm not sure if I am, but it would be really weird for there to be a book partly about me out in the world and not read it. So.
Well, I want to ask about some of the things you brought up in that answer, but let me back up for just a second so you can tell folks how you ended up writing about weddings at the New York Times in the first place.
Sure. So I went to UNC. I was at the went to the journalism school and the J school. And I had been, after I finished school, I had been traveling in Africa. I had gone to visit a friend who's in the Peace Corps in Zambia, and I had spent the summer in Zambia and Zimbabwe and in that area. And when I got back, I had no money, and I was sleeping on a friend's couch. And the assistant dean of the J School emailed me. She forwarded me an email from this guy named Joel Brinkley, who was a reporter at the Times, and his father was David Brinkley, which, if anybody remembers, he was he on CBS?
I think it was NBC, wasn't it? Newscaster?
I can't remember. He was, you know, one of the major first landmark newscasters of the day. And his son, Joel, covered at that point, I think, Energy or something at the Times. And Joel had sent a note saying they needed somebody to answer the phones at the Washington Bureau at the Times. Do you know anybody? And I happened to be sleeping on my best friend's couch in DC or in Arlington, but whatever, in the area. And Jan said, apply for this job. And, you know, you do what the dean of the J school tells you to do. So I went and borrowed some money from my mother and bought some interview pants and did the interview. Actually, no, I think it was over the phone. It did a phone interview. It was like a 10-minute thing. They were like, can you start tomorrow? And I said, I sure can. And that was the end of it. I mean, it was honestly the most unglamorous, most pedestrian way to get a job at the New York Times. But anyway, so I answered the phones in DC for a year, and did all sorts of freelancing and legs, and covered the sniper shootings and wrote about the spelling bee, but I desperately wanted to be in New York. And I had been seeing this guy or dating this guy, and he was up there, and I just wanted to be in New York. It's where I'd wanted to be since I was 7 years old. And so I asked if I could move up there, and they said, sure, what do you want to do? And I said, well, what do you have for a clerk to do? I mean, clerks, they just kind of put them wherever. And they knew that I was an aspiring writer, and I would happen to be moving up there in like late March, early April, which is when the wedding season started. And they said, well, how about writing the wedding announcements? And I said, sure. And to me, a wedding, I had very infrequently read the Times wedding announcements. To me, a wedding announcement was like the thing that you read in the Fayetteville Observer Times that detailed like the flowers and the bride's bouquet and where they were going on their honeymoon and like the names of her entire bridal party and like who appeared on the groom's side and when, you know, what year she was a debutante and all of that stuff, like the things that were in my mother's own announcements. And I thought, sure. And I didn't realize until I got there just how deeply reported they are, like what a big deal they are.
One of the things that struck me as so funny in your book is that part of your job in doing these interviews with the couples was to try to figure out what they did for a living. And it was became fairly obvious with some of these folks that they really didn't do anything except inherit their parents' money, right?
Yep. Yeah, there's a long, really uncomfortable anecdote in the book about I was interviewing this really very nice person who said she was a freelance writer. Now, as you and I both know, it is very hard to make a living as a freelance writer.
Yes.
It's even harder to do that when you live in New York. And that was something that always raised the society editor's it was a red flag for him because he thought, come on, man, like unless they're Carrie Bradshaw writing for Vogue at $3 a word, which doesn't exist or didn't exist then, they're probably a barista as well as a freelance writer, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but like you got it for the purposes of that wedding announcement, you've got to lay it all out. And but this woman, she says she's a freelance writer, but her father, of course, all the identifying details about this person have been changed, including who her dad actually is. But her father is one of the richest people in the United States. I mean, she will never have to lift a finger for money. Neither will probably her great-grandchildren. I mean, there's just, you know, she probably has more money in her bank account right now than I will ever see in my entire life. And I had to go back and ask her, well, okay, so you're a freelance writer, but do you make your living off of that? And, you know, how do you spend your days? And the truth of the matter was she spent her days like going to temps lessons and doing charity work and also writing freelance pieces. But, you know, the elephant in the room, of course, was that, no, she will never have to work because her father has more money than God.
So I had not really thought about it in any detail until I read your book. But one of the things that becomes very clear is that these wedding announcements are sort of crucial cogs in the sort of society of these very wealthy, very powerful people, that it's like super important for those announcements to get in there. But it's not up to them. It's up to the New York Times and you and people like you who are doing that. So what was it like to tell people who expected to be in there that they weren't going to make the cut?
So that privilege, that honor, was 99% of the time not mine. That belonged to the society editor and a man in the book whose name is Ira. The rare times that I had to make or excuse me tell people that or deliver that bad piece of news was when they got caught out in a lie. Because if they lied about any part of their announcement, the general rule was that they were off. They lost their chance. They lost their chance. Unless they were somebody like, I don't know, a Kennedy. Like their wedding was news, actual news. Then you would include it no matter what. But it was incredibly uncomfortable, obviously. But that was when I felt... And again, this was pretty infrequent for me, but that was when I felt at my smallest as a human, I guess, because you get berated by these people who the entire world has been laid out for them on a silver platter. And the week before their wedding, which is obviously a very fraught emotional time for many, many reasons, the week before their wedding, they get told that they can't have something that to them was just as obvious as breathing. of course I get to have this. Like, just like, of course I get to go to Yale because my dad went to Yale and his dad went to Yale and blah, 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 blah. Of course I get to have my announcement in the Times. And not just because of who I am, but because my parents had theirs in and my grandparents and my sister was in 2 years ago, like all, you know, all of those things. All of that leads up to the central idea of like, I deserve this. And when you tell somebody that, well, you messed it up and so you don't deserve it, you don't actually deserve it to begin with, really, honestly. But you, you know, you caused your own demise in this manner. It was, I felt it was hard.
So one sort of technical question on all this, as you talk about in the book a lot about interviewing these prospective brides and grooms, people about to be married, did you always interview them separately?
Mm-hmm. Always.
And was that to make sure their stories matched up, or to, I mean, what were the reasons for that?
Well, part of it was purely logistical. Like, you do it during the workday, and, you know, most of the time these people were at different workplaces. Part of it, I found it useful to make sure that their details matched up. This never happened to me, but I seem to remember that some people had discovered things about the other party in the marriage.
I think there's one little moment in your book when the groom sort of figures out you that the bride was actually 30 and not 29.
Yeah.
And that seemed to make a big difference.
He called with what he thought was an error on Monday. I mean, on Monday mornings, the ritual was I'd come in and check my voicemail, and invariably there'd be a couple of messages from angry brides and grooms because we got a detail wrong in their wedding. And sometimes it was like, I don't know, that we misspelled the name of the church, which was rare, but or I don't know, like we misspelled the name of the bride's mother. I mean, it was these like sort of minute details that really made all the difference to these people who, again, had just come off of, you know, one of the most emotional experiences of their lives. And so they were kind of keyed up, I would say. But anyway, this guy called and left a message and said, you got my wife's age wrong. But that was the age that she had told us. And because that's one of the central questions you ask when you interview these brides and grooms is, what is your full name? What is your preferred name? How old are you? I mean, to the point of like checking their birth dates, not just saying like, oh, you're 29. Okay, well, you were born on May 11th, whatever 29 would be at this point. But yeah, it kind of shocked him and took him aback a little bit. But
so it becomes clear, I think, during the telling of your book that you start to get feelings about whether these marriages are going to work out or not, mm-hmm. or at least your sense of it, based on what their responses are to your questions. So mm-hmm. what were things that were sort of red flags for you, or maybe on the other side, things that somebody said, might said or not say, that made you feel like they would stick?
I was always very sensitive to perceived power imbalances between couples. You know, I mean, the first anecdote in the book is about the former senior senator from the great state of New York. He married a political consultant and subsequently many years later divorced that political consultant in a very hot, highly covered, contentious divorce. I mean, the power imbalance between those two people was impossible. I mean, you know, he was this vaunted, celebrated senator from New York of all places. And she, there are a million political consultants out there, and I'm sure she was very good at her job, but the imbalance is just inherent in their professional, in their careers. So that was one thing that always raised my hackles a little bit. To be perfectly frank, like the grooms could just be jerks, you know? And of course I would have an immediate response to anybody who's being a jerk to me in general, because I often looked at it through a lens of gender, you know? And maybe that was fair, maybe it was not, but when you're a young woman reporting these things out for the Times and a guy is a real jerk to you, it's hard not to take it personally. And it's hard not to feel dismissed based on something that you can't help. And you have to remember too, this was 15 years ago. And so I don't think the Times were that different then, but maybe they were a little different. But then, you know, sometimes I was completely wrong. Like I covered, this is in the book, there's a story about I covered the wedding for the vows column of these two people who met through some pretty inauspicious circumstances. The real circumstances I cannot tell for legal reasons, I'm sorry to say. I would get in so much trouble. But they got married on the sidewalk of a very famous, in front of a very famous jewelry store. And I remember after I covered the wedding, I went home and my roommates and I discussed it. And we were like, there's no way this is going to last. They're still married. This was 15, 16, 17 years ago. They're still doing just fine. And some of the weddings I thought they were, you know, were solid. These people were in it for real. They've gotten divorced. I will say one of the things that, and this I think bore out in coverage, one of the weddings, or the couple that really impressed me that I wrote about was Sheryl Sandberg and Dave Goldberg, who I think, as we all know, he died in a horrible accident when they were vacationing in Mexico. But their marriage and their love for each other and their respect for each other was well documented. I mean, my God, she wrote a book about it, right? And they were very well known for how they created balance in their incredibly hectic, you know, driven professional careers. And then they had two kids on top of it. But I remember even interviewing them thinking, this is fascinating to me, because the way that he talked about her, the way that he talked about her, not just as a person, but like, obviously to them, their careers were front and center of everything that they did. And I'm sure if he were still alive, it would be the same. But just the respect and the admiration he had for her just kind of glowed through the phone. And I remember thinking, this is a possibility. Because that was one of the things that gave me real pause about committing, was like, how do you balance what you want professionally and creatively with what you want personally, you know, all of the things that I think we all go through, anybody who's searching for what they want, especially in their 20s. But that, oddly enough, interviewing the future COO of Facebook helped me figure out what I, and her husband, her late husband, her sweet late husband, helped me figure out what I wanted.
When we come back, I talk to Kate Doty about not knowing the difficulties of love and marriage until you're in the thick of it.
A friend of mine got married a couple of years ago, and I've been married by this point, I don't know, 8 or 9 years. And 2 or 3 days after they got married, she called me, or texted me rather, and she said, "Why didn't you tell me this was so hard?"
That and more ahead on Southbound. Today, I'd like to tell you about one of my favorite new podcasts. It's called Everything Happens with Kate Bowler. The world loves us when we present ourselves as good, better, best. But what if you want to stop feeling guilty that you're not living your best life now? Kate Bowler is a young mom, best-selling author, and Duke University professor who at age 35 was suddenly diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. In warm, insightful, often funny conversations, Kate talks with people about what they've learned in dark times. You'll be reminded that we can find beauty and meaning in truth, but also, there's no cure for being human. Listen to Everything Happens with Kate Bowler wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to my conversation with Kate Doty. You say something in the book, and maybe this gets to this gender thing you were talking about how we're all fixer-uppers. And how we all need to be kind of rehabbed in one way or another. And that part of what a good spouse does is help you do that. I've often wondered if there's a gender difference in thinking about that, where like maybe women think this is an investment property. Women tend to think that men are an investment property. And I'll get them rehabbed and fixed up. And it'll be nice. And men are like looking for something that's move-in ready. And I wonder if you found any of that at all, if that makes any sense to you.
Well, I'm sorry to say that the fixer-upper line sort of came from a song from Frozen. which, if any of you out there are familiar with the song, I think it's actually called Fixer Upper. I can't remember. It's when I don't know if they're gnomes or they're boulders that turn into fairies or something. I don't know. They're singing about Anna and Kristoff and how they both have their flaws, but they find each other through the flaws and they see, you know, the potential and all of that. So thank you, Frozen, for that line. But but I think there's absolutely a truth to that. I think, well, one of the challenges I had writing this book is it's interesting trying to write about the origin of a marriage when you're already so deep into it. Because by that point, by the time I wrote this book, my husband and I had been together 15 years, married for 9. You know, we'd had a kid, like, we've done so many of the things that you expect in a long-term relationship. And so it was really challenging to write about what I saw in this person to begin with versus what I see in him now. And I think that they're a little bit different. I mean, some of it is obviously the same, you know, like a lot of the same attractions are there. But, and that's one of the real beauties of long-term relationships, no matter whether you're married or just, you know, partnered up or whatever, it's constant discovery. And you hope that it is like that. That's the bet that you make when you get married, right? That there will be some constant discovery. And, you know, if you're lucky enough, 15 years from now, you're still going to be learning cool things about the person you think you know better than anybody. And that I feel like is the miracle of relationships. But I do think, you know, it's a good question. You might ask that of my husband, actually, like, was I move-in ready or was I?
Well, what made me think of it was that you were just, you know, talking about how some of these guys you were interviewing came off as real jerks. It made me think, you know, if you're the prospective bride there, why would you marry this guy? And if it's not something cynical, like they've got a lot of money or power or something, mm-hmm. maybe it's that you see some way that you can make him better.
He's got potential. And,
right.
The
right.
things predicating a marriage based on what you think you should be doing. You know, I should be marrying the guy I met who went to Princeton and you know, went to Wharton and is on this upward trajectory, because that's the person, or the, you know, the man or the woman or whoever, that will provide me the economic and social security I need. And I think that's a wildly, very deeply cynical way of looking at it, but I also think it happens to be rooted in some real truths. When I met my husband, he was 25 and I was 24. And I was coming off the tail end of this sort of fraught, uncomfortable relationship. And my then boyfriend had literally left the country. Like, he had gone to do a job in a different country. Like, that was what brought this to an end. And I remember meeting Michael and thinking he was such a good friend. And I was excited to have him as a friend in New York, because I met him right when as the book details, like, I knew him a little bit through email before, because we worked together. Before I moved to the city. But then when I got there, I was excited to have this friend, this somebody who I felt completely comfortable with right off the bat. And I think, you know, movies and literature have explored the idea of whether men and women can really be friends, you know, obviously. But I felt like he was a true friend. And I think he, from the very beginning, had higher aims, I would say. I mean, and he'll tell you flat out he wanted to date me. But I just saw him as somebody who I could invest in for the long haul, as somebody in my life. And that felt like a gift, to especially from moving to a big place I didn't know. Yeah, I knew hardly anybody. And as our relationship progressed, even before we actually started dating, you know, our first kiss on the steps of the public library, I felt like this was somebody who was worth putting time and energy into. And I don't know if he would balk at hearing me talk about him in such a, an Edward Jones.
like a really good Zillow, right?
Even. Yes. But I do think that there is a real difference between the way people think about each other in terms of investment potential and the way women talk about potential partners. You know, I have no idea how guys talk to each other about potential partners, but I do know women think, generally speaking, for the long haul.
So, you know, there are kind of two tracks in this book. Obviously, you're working at the time you're doing these wedding interviews, and you're starting to date this guy and falling in love with him and that sort of thing. Did the work you were doing and interviewing some of these couples that you clearly thought maybe shouldn't be married, did that make you wary of your own feelings?
Oh my God, yeah. Oh, absolutely. It did two things, though. It made me wary of my own feelings, but it also helped clarify them. The guy at the beginning of the book, I had dated for 3 years. I think it's 3 years. And it was like one of those end of college, first years out of college relationships that either end for very good reasons or people get married, at least in the South, you know. But, you know, I was head over heels for this guy. Like, I would have walked across hot coals for him. And part of it was certainly just like lust, you know, and part of it was being young and feeling like I put my entire energy into one person. And then when he went away, when he moved out of the country, when our relationship ended, when I started dating Michael, who's now my husband, our relationship was quite different. And obviously I would walk across hot coals for him. But that sort of like immediate, I would say it was a slow burn. You know, our relationship was a slow burn. Whereas with this other guy whose name is Anand in the book, it was just like this hot flash of like, bam, you know, like we're in it right immediately. And that the differences between those two relationships made me question what love actually was, because I thought that I was so in love with this guy Anand, like I would do anything for him. And, you know, give him every cent in my bank account. And with Michael, my feelings took a lot longer to get there. Although, of course, they're no less deep and fervent now. I mean, if anything, they trump anything I ever felt for Adnan. But anyways, the difference between those two relationships made me think, oh, what am I doing? Like, is this love? Is what I have with Michael, is this the real thing? Or is what, I didn't really understand what it was. But what I had with Michael actually was commitment. What these wedding renouncements helped me realize was that what I had with Michael, what I thank God still have with him, is far more valuable than this flash in the pan thing. And when you talk to these people, especially people who talk with such ardor and fervent love for their soon to be spouses and warmth, you can always, that was the thing that always got me about talking to these people, was the warmth with which they would talk about their future spouse. Because I do understand feeling reserved and talking to a stranger, not wanting to talk to a stranger about the person you're about to marry. That's a little weird. It is a little weird. But by the same token, like when you would get these people to talk and they would really kind of open up about the people that they had hoped to spend the rest of their lives with, that helped clarify for me that it wasn't just this like super hot, you know, bonfire. It was like the slow warmth that you need every morning when you wake up.
What about being married has surprised you?
Oh, golly. The resiliency. the way that love regenerates and grows, you know, if you're in a good one. If you're in a good one, and you're doing the work that it requires. I mean, a friend of mine got married a couple of years ago, and I've been married by this point, I don't know, 8 or 9 years. And 2 or 3 days after they got married, she called me, or texted me rather, and she said, "Why didn't you tell me this was so hard?"
Already?
I know. And then on their honeymoon, and I was like, what? I mean, there are some extenuating circumstances that made that particular portion of it was extremely challenging. But the central point remained, like, it's kind of like having a kid too. Like, you know, you wouldn't believe it until you're in it, because some of it says too bonkers. But, you know, a couple of years ago, the year before my husband and I took buyouts from the Times, we were on the schedule in which we had a newborn or an infant. I was working days, he was working nights. We were living upstate New York, and so we commuted 2 hours each way every day. We only saw each other 20 minutes a day, and that was because he would come. We would dash upstairs to the cafeteria for a cup of coffee before I had to go like make the 5:10 bus to get back to East Jesus Nowhere to go pick up my kid to get her home in time for a reasonable bedtime. And he was working on the politics desk too at that point. This was the 2016 election, and he was the night editor. And so he was dealing with all of like the 3 a.m. Trump tweets. I mean, it was just insane. And so we didn't see each other. We lived in a situation that we really, of our own making, that we hated. We had the stresses that come with having a baby. And the stresses that come with these crazy jobs, and our marriage really started to falter. And most of it was external circumstances, but we also weren't dealing with the changes very well. And we also probably made too many big changes too quick, but anyway. And that was like, the fact that we made it through that, it still feels like a miracle to me in a lot of ways.
I wonder if the last year, the pandemic or so, has been sort of the opposite thing, right? So before you were together 20 minutes a day, now maybe you're together 24 hours a day. And I wonder how that changed things, or what discoveries that revealed.
Well, we're very lucky in that we both have home offices in which we can shut the door. And I think a lot of people who are stuck at home probably don't have that advantage. We're extremely lucky. That said, my husband is a reporter for Cardinal and Pine, which is a local outfit here. And they have, they rented office space in the Durham Underground a couple of months ago. And he started going there a couple of days a week. And we have found that that is better for all. And also, like, we need to be able to miss each other. It's nice to be able to catch up at the end of the day and not already know every single effing thing that happened that day, because you heard it
while it was happening. Yeah.
So, yes.
So just a couple of sort of, I guess, kind of advice type questions I wanted to wrap up with for people who might be listening to this. First of all, did anybody that you interviewed give you some sort of tip about something like you would do in your wedding or something that you used or just thought was a really cool idea?
Yes. Yes. So I think everybody has, or everybody who probably gets married in Protestant or Jewish, you know, weddings in general have readings. I remember I talked to somebody, I forget who it was, and they were including snippets of plays that they loved in their wedding, in their ceremony. And I thought, that's awesome. And so my husband, so our favorite movie that we watched together is The Birdcage, which is the Robin Williams, Nathan Lane movie about the drag queen. And it's a wonderful movie and it stands on its own, but it's a really lovely, intimate depiction of a long-term relationship. And there's this one monologue that Robin Williams does. Nathan Lane's character is demanding that he gets a palimony agreement because he wants to make sure he like inherits all the money when Robin Williams dies, his character dies. And these people have been together like 20 years or 25 years, like they'd raised a son together. And they were as solid as two people could be together. But there's this monologue that Robin Williams does after Albert, who's Nathan Lane's character, has just gone off the deep end yet again about something. And he talks about how like he gives him the palimony agreement, and in the palimony agreement, it shows that Albert actually owns all of the property. And the palimony agreement says that Robin Williams's character has the right, like that Nathan Lane's character has the right to give Robin Williams's character half of everything he owns, showing that like Robin Williams has put not just his faith, or not just like his financial faith, but like all of his faith and all of his trust and all of his love and joy and his life into this single person. And after this person I talked to was saying they're including snippets of readings of plays in their readings, we had a friend of ours who's an actor read that monologue at our wedding, and it still chokes me up when I think about it.
The last thing to maybe sum up all this, you know, you've obviously been through your own marriage now for a while, and you have written about many, many, many marriages in the past. So there's probably some young couple listening to this now, or some young woman or young man who's trying to figure out maybe if they want to get married and that sort of thing. If they were sitting in front of you, what would you tell them?
Oh gosh, I would tell them that the whole happily ever after ideal is a crock. It's complete. I mean, you've been in a long-term relationship, like you know that like happily ever after is baloney, right? Like nobody rides off into the sunset. But I do think that there's always joy on the horizon in a good relationship.
I remember hearing a story about a musician who was getting married for the fourth or fifth time, And at the altar, while everybody waited for the bride to come down the aisle, he turned to his best man and said, "Nobody can say that I'm afraid of commitment. It's a daunting thing to commit to one person for the rest of your life. The proof is not just in the divorce rate, but in the number of people who never get married in the first place. Staying together, staying committed, is one of life's greatest joys. But don't let anybody tell you that it's not also a struggle. The gift Kate Doty got from her work, and the gift she passes on to us in her book, is the ability to see it all with a clearer eye, to understand the mistakes couples make, and to believe in the value of a marriage that works. She's right, I guess, in that there's really no happily ever after. But in a good marriage, a lot of times, it feels like there is. And that's a feeling worth fighting for." Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.